peaceful sit-in, complaining about their treatment and the neglect of another political prisoner, which led to his death after more than a decade of protests by the Bahraini people. The regime continues with its brutal attack against the people of this country, both inside of prisons and out.
Protests are growing in Bahrain inside and outside prison walls, so is the regime crackdown. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Office described as disturbing the Bahraini regime's use of force to break up a peaceful sit-in at the country's main prison mid-April. OICHR slammed as unnecessary and disproportionate the violent repression of the sit-in at Jao Prison, located south of the capital, Manama. The inmates have been demonstrating against detention conditions, particularly the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in started in early April after the death of a political prisoner due to reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. Outside the prison, Bahrainis have been holding similar protests, calling for the release of political prisoners and better conditions. OICHR says the lack of healthcare in overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, which has turned into a chronic problem due to the coronavirus pandemic. It says Manama's response to protests has been in the form of more detentions. Thousands of opposition politicians, activists, journalists, and human rights defenders have been imprisoned in Western allied Bahrain since an uprising in 2011 and subsequent years of crackdown.
The Bahraini regime has been clamping down very viciously on these political prisoners that have been protesting against appalling conditions in Bahraini prisons. These are, in fact, political prisoners, it's important to emphasize, because these are people that had protested very peacefully back in 2011, demanding political reforms, democratic rights and human rights, and even citizenship rights. They've been protesting not only against the appalling conditions that exist there, but these conditions have been worsened as a consequence of the pandemic.
Bahrain's most prominent cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, says drawing up a new constitution is the only way out of the political crisis. He has urged the regime to pursue an agreement with the opposition instead of increasingly suppressing the dissidents. That advice is likely to fall on deaf ears, given over 10 years of crackdown. However, with every protest chipping away at the legitimacy and authority of the Al-Khalifa regime, it is only fast-tracking the inevitable, which cannot be suppressed.
I'd like to welcome my first guest out of Washington, D.C., author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman. Michael, great to have you with us. Now, Michael, when we look at the situation in Bahrain, I mean, what is it about the regime? Why is the regime so repressive against the people there? What is it trying to get to?
Well, it's trying desperately to hold on to power, and it's been backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States since the beginning of the protest 10 years ago, with the Saudis invading the country to help crack down on people who wanted a better way of life and a little bit of democracy. And of course, the United States supports it militarily and financially, using it as the base for the Fifth Fleet that sails the Persian Gulf instead of the American Gulf. And there are some 20,000 soldiers, sailors, and Marines there. And the Americans love this, and it puts money in the coffers. It's propped up the Al-Khalifa dynasty. So if this were taken away, the country would collapse, if you can call it a country. It's basically a city with some dirt around it. And there wouldn't be any more Khalifas, there wouldn't be any more overcrowded prisons, there wouldn't be any more beatings, there wouldn't be any more killings. But unfortunately, nobody will do anything about it. It's like the weather. You always talk about it, but you don't do anything about it.
And let's look at the other side of the coin, Michael, because on the one hand, we have the regime, which is behaving so oppressively. On the other hand, we have, as far as those countries that they're giving this regime full support, we're talking about, especially these Western countries like the United States or like the UK. What's in it for them? Why are they supporting this repressive regime?
Well, course, it's value for money. They sell weapons and other sorts of arms and ammunition and things to the caliphs to control their country. And also, it's used as a base against Iran. It's one of the many bases that the Americans have built encircling the country. And they see the Fifth Fleet sailing up and down the Persian Gulf as a way of controlling Iran and keeping Iran from exercising even a modicum amount of control in the region there, in the water. They scream bloody murder every time a couple of motorboats sail within a couple of hundred meters of an American warship. So it's, again, it's money for the merchants of death, and it's control, political control, and economic control aimed at Iran.
Well, welcome my next guest out of London from Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, Reza, why do we not see more forceful language being used by this UN office? Now, it said it is disturbed by what has happened in the prison in Manama, but it doesn't seem to hold it responsible or demand any type of action. Your take on that?
I think one of the things that we need to recognize that the United Nations is going to be is often limited by the powers like Britain, like America, who have particular influences that they bring to bear on Bahrain and what they want to do. And so when that kind of control is there, it makes it very difficult for the United Nations officials to be able to say the things that really should be said. It's quite clear what has gone on. It is unacceptable. It is clearly problematic and so on. So there are some serious issues in terms of that that need to be addressed. But this is a historical problem. This is something that has been going on in Bahrain for a number of years, where Britain would actually try to be the champion of democracy and lecture people around the world, when in fact it's ex-British police officers and MI6 agents and so on have been involved and managing the torture of people in Bahrain, anyone who rises up or says something against the government. And this is something that goes back decades in terms of how Britain has actually been playing a very dirty role on the ground, and people from official places like the MI6 or like the police and so on, or ex-police officers and so on, are directly involved in managing how this is actually controlled and what actually happens on the ground in terms of the regime and legitimizing the regime and the managing when things of this ilk actually happen. So this is going back in terms of the stuff that happens for quite some time. So it's not surprising in a sense.
Well, Michael, the majority of these prisoners are political prisoners, meaning they're activists, they're former politicians, they're academics, etc. And we don't see or hear a whole lot. I mean, they're being basically incarcerated due to their beliefs. But, I mean, when we look at a situation, for example, we have a situation right now in Russia where an individual, the West is calling him a political prisoner, or it can be other places like Venezuela or Iran, and we see what they do when they talk about political prisoners. But we have these individuals and so many of them that are in Bahraini jails, but nothing is being done. Why?
Well, first off, as you mentioned, the people that are being targeted by the United States and the European Union, such as President Putin of Russia and Maduro in Venezuela and the Castros in Cuba, they want the American government wants these people overthrown. They want the legitimate government of Iran overthrown and replaced by governments friendly to the West, governments that will do the bidding of the apartheid entity, the South and South Israel. But God forbid that anyone should question the so-called allies of the United States, the organizations and countries that facilitate the operation of the American Imperium around the world. Bahrain is one great example of this. Without Manama as the home port of the American Fifth Fleet, the Americans would have a substantial loss of control in the region. So they pick and they choose They support human rights when they want to overthrow a government or gain political influence. They turn a blind eye to places like Iran and Saudi Arabia and the apartheid entity when they engage in murder, war crimes, and human rights violations because it's in their interest. They have friends. They have people that will give them influence, that will do translations and dirty work and things like this. And therefore, the Americans love that.
Well, Reza, we have witnessed protests on and off now for over a decade in Bahrain. Do you think that there has been any progress regarding human rights in that country, or has the situation deteriorated?
I think over that period of time, it would be fair to say that things have actually deteriorated quite considerably. And I think what is further telling within all of this, that while there was some kind of lip service that was being paid initially to what was going on, being unacceptable, gradually over a period of time, this has actually changed, and there is indifference towards political indifference, no political will, and no kind of desire to hide their indifference.
Why is that? Let me just jump in here, Reza. You said no desire to even hide their indifference. So what does that mean? And does that mean there is absolutely no accountability, not obviously inside the country and not from international entities? Your take.
Yeah, so within the country, it's even things like where you've got medical concerns of individual prisoners, and we've seen that whether it's cancer cases, whether it's the corona or issues to do with that, whether it's looking after people who have got medical conditions, all of that has been used as a weapon. So it's been weaponized to deliberately ignore those symptoms, those problems, and those issues to make sure that those people's conditions actually worsen. So it's a systematic problem. It's a systemic problem. So at any level of in terms of basic humanity and human rights or humanitarian kind of issues that are raised by these things, you would have expected that there would have been an outcry regarding making sure that those people got the treatment, were treated, and had their legitimate medical needs and so on met. But there's been a systemic and systematic abuse of that within, and no kind of calling out of this on the international level by either the British government or the American government. And to not even do that is clearly a signal of what's they don't care, and they're not worried about the fact that they are seen to not care. And I think it's those kind of things that suggest that there is very little accountability by them of the Bahraini regime and what it's doing, and also their minions in terms of British police officers that are on the ground in Bahrain managing some of these things in terms of what's actually going on, managing the publicity around this and so on and so forth. So all of these things are very much intertwined. And I think that lack of accountability on the international level is also a problem and needs to be recognized mm-hmm. and called out for what it is. I mean, they don't care, and they don't care that they are shown to not care either. And I think the solutions need to the problems in Bahrain will need to be coming from elsewhere, because if you're looking for the West to provide those solutions, it's not going to happen. They need to be coming. New thought needs to be given to that.
Okay. Well, Michael, originally protests called for political reforms through peaceful demonstrations, but the regime could not even tolerate that. So what do you make of this? And so what are the options? I mean, Reza just said that there has to be some new thought about basically help is not coming from the outside. So what needs to happen in your perspective?
Well, what needs to happen is that the United Nations has got to stop talking and wringing its hands about how things are bad there. The United States State Department's report on human rights on Bahrain for last year goes through a litany of its crimes against the people and its repression to the point where in prison you're not safe because you're beaten, you have poor medical care, and so forth. I think that short of an armed invasion of Bahrain, as the United Nations sanctioned in Korea in the early 1950s, and then in the 90s in Yugoslavia and in Iraq, nothing's going to be done. You've got to point out exactly what's happening. You've got to get the international news media to break their ties with government and point out exactly what is being done to the people of Bahrain by the American-supported government, by the British-supported government. And we've got to really point the finger and publicize this. Certainly publicizing what went on in South Africa brought an end to apartheid. And if you can get the news media to do the same thing in Israel or the same thing with Bahrain, it might be another story, but that's a big task, and you've got to persuade these corporate giants that it's in their interest to report the news factually and carefully and accurately.
Reza, Sheikh Isa Qasim, the main religious leader, of course, of Bahrain, says a new constitution is the only way to end the repression in that country. Your take on that, and what would it take for that to happen?
I think in terms of the new constitution and so on, I can't see the Bahraini authorities agreeing to that, because that would mean limiting the powers that the king would have, the limiting the powers that would be had in order to continue the oppression that they are doing in terms of meeting the needs and the aspirations of the Bahraini people. So while this is a legitimate demand, and I think it's appropriate that something like this is instigated and done and provides an alternative about what the way forward could be, and it says very clearly to people looking into Bahrain internationally that, look, there are solutions on the ground that are legitimate, that are valid, and all of those things are there, I think it's very appropriate that something like that is happening. But at the same time, don't hold your breath that this is going to be something that's going to be, they're going to roll over and allow that to be done and the new constitution to be brought in, because it will be, to, you know, which oppressor would like their powers to be limited in any way? Which person, megalomaniac, is going to want to have their powers limited? And that's simply not going to happen. And
so you said that another thought process, sorry to interrupt you, I'm just so limited in time, but you said another thought process, Reza, has to be taken into consideration. Because as I said earlier, repeating what you said, that the help is not going to come from those Western powers or the so-called international agency that's supposed to be dealing with human rights. So what's the answer in your perspective? What has to be done?
So I think it's a multitude of things that need to happen. I mean, if there are people sitting outside, I mean, it's looking at grassroots, it's looking at institutional links with Bahrain. So whether it's academic, whether it's on the sporting field, whether it's any of those kind of things that can, so whether it's Formula One that goes there, targeting those people and those kind of things to actually say, you need to rein back, you need to pull out, because this, you, what you're doing is supporting a regime which is oppressive and so on and so forth. So I think at one level, it's got to be that. At the grassroots level within Bahrain, we need to think about, you know, it's like any oppressive system or any oppressive government. Are they going to roll over? They're not, unless you give them and make them an offer and provide them the resistance that is required to make them realize that an alternative offer is actually worthwhile in terms of taking, and think about how that resistance needs to be manifested. So that there is one level in terms of demonstrations, in terms of all of these things that are going to be taking place on the ground, and they have been happening for years and decades in some senses, in terms of what's been going on. Obviously, with the whole 2011 and where it started, there was an intensity that was created after that period of time that it was going on for. But I think obviously all of these things will continue, but I think another angle in terms of whether looking at resistance in a different kind of form might be an option that needs to be looked at. So I think that I would say that people need to look at those options. And when those options are on the table, the government will start to think, okay, is it really going to be worth my while to take on a resistance that is going to be much more assertive and aggressive in what they do?
Okay, and on that note, appreciate you being with us, both of you, actually. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C. Always a pleasure, Michael. And Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem, out of London. Thank you so much. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
شهر الخير والرحمة دعني الشوق والإيمان بقربك هلت الدمعة يا شهر الخير والرحمة دعني الشوق والإيمان بقربك هلت الدمعة
Insights into the Holy Quran, a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends. But we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go, 'cause your time is set by Allah. Oh Ramadan, oh Ramadan, you're the month of the noble Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya ayyuhal
O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, we were talking about this verse of the Holy Quran. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ O you who believe, fasting is prescribed for you just as it was prescribed for the nations before you, that you may gain self-restraint. We started talking about the concept of taqwa. We tried to define it and we understood the significance of it. We also understood the significance of fasting from the abundant results, both quantitatively and qualitatively. And It is interesting that for the taqwa itself, numerous fruits have been mentioned in the Holy Quran, and even narrations. For example, the Holy Quran says, وَمَنْ يُعَذِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ. And whoever respects the signs of Allah, it is the outcome of the piety of the hearts. The Arabic word شَعَائِر, used in the Quran, has different meanings. One of them is used for the Hajj rituals, including the stops in certain places, circumambulation, and sa'y, which is the running between Safa and Marwa. The second meaning is the camel, which is fattened for sacrifice. The third meaning is the religion of God. But the most important of them all, I assume, is the fourth one, which is anything signifying obedience to God, for the performance of which man rises, and something that any negligence of it is not permissible. In this relation, God says, do not violate the signs appointed to Allah. So, when it is said one of the fruits and effects of piety is to observe religious rituals, it means that a pious man has to perform duties in relation to the religion that God has determined, and the Holy Prophet ﷺ and the Imams of the Guidance have elaborated. But this obedience must be with devotion and love. Even if one fails to perform such duties, he has to ask God to help and give him the blessing of its performance. And this verse of the Holy Quran is actually, the word taqwa is used in it to show that Hajj rituals are an example of the divine decree, and they are the result of piety of the heart. Because when a heart is completely purified, it has the capacity to direct a man to act according to the rules of religion. And that is the time when the heart can actually drive the man to act based upon the decrees of God. Only a diseased heart disobeys and rebels against the path of the guidance and truth.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان. فَمَنْ شَهِدَ مِنْكُمُ الشَّهْرَ فَلْيَصُمْ وَمَنْ كَانَ مَرِيضًا أَوْ عَلَى سَفَرٍ فَعِدَّةٌ مِنْ أَيَّامٍ أُخَرَ يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرَ وَلَا يُرِيدُ بِكُمُ الْعُسْرَ وَلِتُكْمِلُوا الْعِدَّةَ وَلِتُكَبِّرُوا اللَّهَ ولتكبروا الله على ما هداكم ولعلكم تشكرون.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Now, with regard to what we said earlier regarding the levels of fasting, now it has become more clear what the different aims of fasting are. We said that fasting has got different levels. In the first level, the person who is fasting is just observing simple rules. He's just keeping himself from eating and drinking. But how can this level of fasting help a man reach piety? That the verse says, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. We said that he has to think upon this fact, that why the Almighty Allah has made me do this? I mean, what's the use of self-refrainment from what is halal? And when that happens, that person would understand that if he can control himself, if he can keep his distance from all the things that are halal, but in a specific period of time, then it would be easier for him
to keep the refrainment from the things that are actually hurtful for him, both to his body and to his soul. And this is the only case when he can achieve the higher levels, and actually he can understand that his heart can obey. Then his heart is purified, and this is the sense and reality of servitude. And actually this is why the Almighty Allah says, do not violate the signs appointed by Allah. One of the effects of true taqwa is that the one does not transgress the appointed signs of Allah. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. وتعظم المولى القدير وتعبد المنان وتحفز النفس الكريم.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRAD English Radio, for listening to us. If you have any question or comment, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at farstoday.com. May Allah accept your deeds in this holy month of Ramadan, and please include all Muslims in your prayers. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. وبصومها وصلاتها تزداد بالحسنات وتصدق في سرها وتلاوة القرآن وبليلة القدر العظيمة قدرها فتان وتعتق الأرواح من مخزونة النيران وتمتلئ في السماء تجلل الرحمن وتعظم المولى القدير وتعبد المنان بحلول شهر الصوم والرحمات والرضوان بحلول شهر الصوم والرحمات والرضوان.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, we're in the month of Ramadan. And the month of Ramadan is one of the most blessed months of the Islamic calendar. One of the reasons why this month is blessed and sacred is that the Quran was revealed in this month. In the Holy Quran, we read that God Almighty says, "Shahru Ramadan, alladhi unzila fihi al-Quran." This is a famous verse of the Holy Quran. The month of Ramadan, the month in which the Quran was revealed. A lot of people ask the following question regarding this verse and the month of Ramadan in general. And that's this, that we know that history tells us that the Quran was revealed gradually to the Holy Prophet in a very lengthy period of time. It began when the Prophet was first delegated and appointed as a prophet of God, until he finally, you know, close to the end of his life before his passing away. So doesn't this contradict what we practically see occur in history? The answer to this question is that the Quran was revealed in two ways. In one way, the Quran was revealed in its entirety and as a whole to the heart of the Holy Prophet. This is what we say occurred in the holy month of Ramadan. However, the Quran was also revealed gradually and in piecemeal, at different times throughout the life of the Holy Prophet. So there's no contradiction here between these two statements, the statement that the Quran was revealed in the Holy Month of Ramadan and that it was revealed throughout the life of the Holy Prophet. Now, of course, this gives rise to another question, and that's this, that what is the purpose of this these two ways of sending the Quran down to the Holy Prophet? The answer to this question is quite simple, and that is that the Quran, even though the Prophet was given the Quran in an entirety, and it was sent down to him in the holy month of Ramadan, Inna anzalnahu fi laylatil qadr, God says that we sent it down in the Holy Quran in the night of Qadr, the night of power, which occurs in the month of Ramadan. At the same time, he descended it and he sent it down throughout the life of the Holy Prophet. In one of the verses of the Holy Quran, God Almighty mentions the reason why he sent it down gradually. لِنُصَبِّتَ بِهِ فُوَادَكْ, so that in this way we could strengthen your heart by means of this. In other words, this gradual descent of the Holy Quran throughout the life of the Prophet was a reminder. Obviously, when you're told something, it's a natural human tendency that when he's told something once and it's repeated to him a number of times, it becomes entrenched in his mind, in his soul, and in his heart. So this was the reason why it was sent down gradually. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the descent of the Holy Quran in the life of the Prophet and in the month of Ramadan. Thank you for joining us here today. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Around the World with Reporters.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized a mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in Al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and the key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territories.
In the middle of the holy month of Ramadan, the historic Jama Mosque in Srinagar, the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir, wears a deserted look. So are the other religious places across the region, Amid rapid surge in COVID cases, the religious bodies here have suspended congregational prayers and other religious gatherings.
We should understand the present situation. We request everyone to offer prayers at home instead of going to mosques. In this holy month, let's all pray for those affected by this virus and for an end to the pandemic.
Authorities in Kashmir have imposed lockdown to curb a surge in COVID infections and deaths. The announcement to impose lockdown came after the region recorded 700% increase in active COVID infections in this month alone, sending the alarm bells ringing. Officials have already banned gathering of more than four people, but essential services have been exempted from the lockdown. Authorities claim that there is no shortage of oxygen, medicines, and COVID vaccine in the region, saying the government is handling the COVID situation effectively. But some people blame authorities for their late response to the pandemic.
There was no robust system of testing at the airport, at the Srinagar airport. And the biggest problem in our case was that the government and the administration here threw open Tulip Garden and organized other Khelo programs, mass gatherings, fashion shows. So this was to showcase normalcy. And in the process, what happened that from 50 odd cases per day, now we are here where we have more than 3,000 cases on a daily basis. And there are 30 plus deaths.
India, the world's second most populous nation, remains in deep crisis as hospitals and morgues are overwhelmed by the pandemic, with medicine and oxygen in short supply and strict limits on movement imposed in the country's largest cities.
The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic is causing a steep rise in the number of infections and posing a huge challenge for health experts and the government here. Experts have warned that the fight against the pandemic is far from over and have urged the people not to drop their guard against the deadly virus. Sadly, South Indian administered Kashmir.
Palestinian refugees and Lebanese factions have held several gatherings in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds. Lebanese political representatives denounced the Israeli aggressive practices both in the occupied territories and the besieged Gaza Strip.
So we are here today to say to the world, and to especially to the Arab people, not the Arab leaders, that they should unite and stand against what's happening. They should be united against the crimes against humanity we are seeing. Innocent people are being bombarded every day. Innocent kids and people are being killed every day, and nobody's lifting a finger.
Palestinian factions stress that as long as Palestinians are able to protect their historic right to their homeland, then there is no fear that Israel or any collaborators can steal it away.
The battle for Al-Quds is a battle on behalf of the entire nation, so the least we can do is to give support to this intifada. This is an extension of several uprisings since 2015 and until today. The occupation forces want to grasp control over the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its surroundings. Palestinian protesters need support, and today we tell them that the Al-Quds is not alone. We saw the support from the West Bank and Gaza to Al-Quds, which shows that Jerusalem Al-Quds won't be left alone.
The speech is noted that all the resistance factions, whether in Lebanon or Palestine, and the entire resistance bloc, united stands with the Palestinian people in their fight for freedom and life.
Your steadfastness is a humiliation to the occupation. We stand with you every single day, and soon we will liberate Palestine.
I tell our brothers in Al-Quds that God is with you, and this means no one can defeat you. I tell all the people of Palestine, hold on, victory is near. You're the rightful owners of this land.
Protests and confrontations broke out in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds after Israeli authorities decided to break a pledge of respecting the right to worship by forcing their way into Al-Aqsa Mosque's four minarets in order to silence the evening call to prayers. The Israeli violence has evoked anger across the Arab and Muslim worlds.
A salute to Jerusalem Al-Quds and the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in the Holy Land is what Lebanese and Palestinian activists have gathered for today. And despite all blockades and Israeli aggressive policies, they stress that the younger generations will resist more than ever before. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
After a still deeply disputed election,
New United States President Joe Biden has reached 100 days in office with a lower approval rating than any other newly elected president since 1953, excepting Donald Trump. Many believe the country is only in a temporary political calm, which could be broken with the reported return of Trump to the political rally circuit in May.
Well, I don't know if the honeymoon is over. I think in some cases the honeymoon was over a few days after the inauguration, or even before the inauguration.
Biden finally gave his address, where he also unveiled a 10-year social infrastructure plan, which is expected to get many months of pushback from Congress. Many say Biden has had some successes: the coronavirus vaccine distribution, the $2 trillion infrastructure plan, ending the Muslim travel ban, and returning to the Paris Climate Agreement. But Biden has already backtracked from campaign promises in many vital areas. The fight for $15 per hour, the amount and length of unemployment payments, total household stimulus payments, dropping Medicare eligibility to 60 years old, student debt relief, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich, and more.
He's reneged on everything he promised, and he comes up with an excuse. I can't do it, or we can't do it because one guy's voting against it. We can't do it because the parliamentarian has decided we can't put it in the bill. I mean, people are pretty much aware that these are lame excuses, and that the Democrats, and Biden especially, are just using these lame excuses to not do what they said they would do.
At 100 days and amid similar economic disaster, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had passed 15 major bills which established hugely influential initiatives. Contrarily, Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package didn't establish a single long-term program. On foreign policy, Biden has adopted almost all of the stances of his controversial predecessor. He has not lifted sanctions on Iran nor returned to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. Russia's foreign minister said Biden's refusal of diplomacy and lack of respect could make relations worse than even during the Cold War. He has not taken Cuba off the state terrorist list, and he adopted Trump's widely criticized low quota for asylum seekers despite a crisis on the southern border. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a sharp rise in racism against Asians, hate crimes against Chinese, East, and Southeast Asians, and the horrific Atlanta shootings in the U.S. threw the topic into stark relief. In Britain, too, violence against Asians has become a bigger problem than it already was. According to one statistic, hate crimes against Asians in Britain increased fourfold in the first quarter of last year, a trend that continues to this day.
I was in my eye test appointment, and there was two spaces between me, and every single people that came didn't choose to sit next to me.
I feel unsafe when I'm by myself, so I just like listen to the music. But you know, some people are still gonna say something when they see Asian people.
Before there were any lockdowns, the Chinese and other ethnic communities had already been suffering abuse as a result of fear and misunderstanding stoked by internet conspiracies. Then came former U.S. President Donald Trump pointing the finger of blame for the pandemic at China.
Many of the victims have started telling their stories on social media, where they're receiving increasing attention. Among them, a growing number of Asian healthcare workers, such as this nurse, racially abused by a patient whose very life he was helping save.
Racism does exist in our society. It's mirrored colonialism. Britain has been the largest colonial power, arguably, for the last 200 to 300 years. And an ideology that particularly came with the Victorians has risen to reflect that, one of European supremacy, and particularly British supremacy and white supremacy.
The thought of the UK being unsafe is a sentiment shared by British Asian healthcare workers. Some have thought of moving elsewhere, but have had to stay because of the pandemic-imposed restrictions on travel and immigration.
A disproportional number of them drawn, especially from overseas, who trained overseas, find themselves in subordinate positions within in the NHS. So despite their skill, despite their education, they're less likely to be in substantive consultant positions. They're more likely to be at staff grade, at sub-consultant level, career grade, to find it hard to progress. So there's like a glass ceiling.
The easing or lifting of lockdown measures should ordinarily come as exciting news for many. But for the Asian community in Britain, among them frontline healthcare professionals, the bitter experiences of the past year will continue to impact their lives for years to come. Saeed Puriza, London.
The socioeconomic malaise that has been worsened by the COVID crisis is erupting at an unprecedented level everywhere in Italy. Many hundreds large and small-scale protests have been held across the country over the past months. On Wednesday, thousands of street vendors staged a protest against a city decision to stop the extension of their licenses. They blocked the capital's Ring Road and occupied the central Republic Square as tens of thousands of itinerant street trading businesses are at risk of closure due to an EU directive on free trade.
Italy has been under attack since the EU introduced the Bolkestein Directive, which aims at establishing a single market for services. Our Parliament has already opposed the adoption of this provision.
We have been abandoned in these testing times. How dare they? The mayor wants to impose standards in Rome. She's killing us.
Also on Wednesday, pilots, flight attendants and other airline industry workers gathered in central Rome to stage a protest against a rescue plan to save the bankrupt former national airline Alitalia. The airline is running out of cash for fuel and salaries, and workers fear some 7,000 employees will be sacked if a buyout offer by a group of investors gets the green light from the government.
The government is not listening to our demands. We have not even been paid last month. That's how Alitalia special commissioners are treating us.
The Draghi government is not used to listening to workers' needs. I am afraid this executive can only make unpopular decisions.
Recently, Italy's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's European Union-funded pandemic recovery plan worth 248 billion euros. Prime Minister Draghi has pledged the plan would address both the damage caused by COVID and the country's long-standing structural issues.
Italy is at a crossroads. There is the risk that the pandemic may turn into an unprecedented socio-economic crisis that will drag on for a very long time. But Italians also have the opportunity to use the funds from a vigorous stimulus package of the EU to relaunch employment and growth. It remains to be seen whether the country will succeed in this process. Max Civili, Rome.
As the world marks World Immunization Week 2021, people in Gaza don't have enough vaccines because of Israeli restrictions. World Immunization Week, celebrated every year and the last week of April, aims to promote the use of vaccines to protect people of all ages against disease. The Gaza Strip has only received enough vaccines for about 50,000 people. More vaccines are desperately needed as the current volume of doses is not enough for the more than 2 million people living in Gaza. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of medical supplies, including vaccines.
Under international law, Israel as an occupying power must adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics in areas under its occupation. Israel must supply the people of the Gaza Strip with all necessary means to combat the coronavirus, including vaccines.
The surge in infections and deaths is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade. Currently, there are some 15,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip.
The health situation is very dangerous, and hospitals are going through very tough times. Every day we lose loved ones because of this deadly pandemic. We need all the necessary help to fight this wave of infections.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic. the enclave's health sector has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
The Israeli blockade since 2007 has taken its toll on Gaza's health sector and left it in a very bad shape. The health sector is fragile and suffers from acute shortages in medicines and hospital supplies to deal with deadly pandemic. Hospitals and medical centers also need more trained medical personnel to deal with the surge of infections.
The Gaza Strip is currently witnessing the worst wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the besieged coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A month of campaigning for an official British definition of Islamophobia has climaxed, with a flash mob protest staged by activist Maz Salim, who lit up government buildings with the image of her father, Mohammed Salim, who was murdered by a racist terrorist in 2013.
I'm here outside UK Parliament to force this government, the media and the police to recognise my father's death as an act of terrorism, as well as the three mosque bombings in the West Midlands. It's been actually quite horrendous. Over the last 8 years, my father's death has been ignored on the mainstream media. Whenever they talk about acts of terrorism in the UK or on UK soil, my father's act of terrorism, and not only my father's death, the three mosque bombings that followed, have always been missed off the list, even though Pablo Lapshin was charged under terrorism laws. So my anger at the media and the politicians is, and the police as well, is intense.
Despite appeals from the family, British media refuses to prescribe the murder as a terrorist incident, which Ms. Salim believes comes from institutional Islamophobia.
When it's a Muslim who is the perpetrator, they get global media attention, back-to-back news headlines. But when the Muslim is the victim, we don't get the same media coverage.
Anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the increase under the current government's watch, with complaints met with silence.
When Prime Minister Boris Johnson referred to Muslim women as bank robbers and letterboxes in 2019, Islamophobic incidences surged, with a 375% spike recorded at the time. Now, with such high-level leadership engaging in anti-Muslim prejudice, can we expect to see meaningful change despite the tireless effort from these anti-racism campaigners? That has yet to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Marib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Marib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Marib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Atum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib.
Al-Tuma al-Ulya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Airbase in Asir in Britain for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, my dear. Allah, my Lord. Allah, my Lord. He's worth
upon, praise be upon, praise be upon, I am Muslim for all of time.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect